Hey, I'm Sana Qadar, host of All in the Mind on ABC Radio National, and I have a question for you. Have you ever wondered what is going on inside someone else's head? I think about this a lot because on All in the Mind, we cover psychology and mental health and why people behave the way they do.
How do other people make this decision?
Maybe it's sending a signal to someone about the reliability of someone.
How can this possibly be?
So if you like the sound of that, check out All in the Mind on the ABC Listen app.
Hi, I'm Tegan Taylor, and this is Life Matters, where your stories shape the national conversation. One of last year's key stories was the state of Australia's childcare system. Staff shortages, in some shocking cases, abusive staff. And sitting underneath all of this, the sense that we need to do better by our kids. One of the options when it comes to change, universal childcare. What would that look like? And how could it work? That is coming up in the next 20 minutes. Also ahead, where in your body do you reside? A small number of scientists are fascinated by the promise of head transplants, which has got me thinking less of the mechanics and more of the ethics. If your head was placed on a different body, would you still be you? We're getting metaphysical today here on ABC Radio National. But first, earlier this week at the BAFTA Awards, Tourette's advocate John Davidson was in the audience to celebrate the success of a film inspired by his life called I Swear. The film ended the night with a stack of awards, including Best Original Screenplay based on Davidson's memoir. But another moment earlier in the ceremony has since overshadowed the film's success. As Michael B. Jordan and Delroy Lindo took to the stage to present the first award, Davidson shouted a racial slur from the audience.
Delroy and I are delighted to be presenting the first BAFTA of the night for a vital part of movie making.
We're here to celebrate the artists who expand.
It was an involuntary tick that he had no control over, but intent can't erase impact. In a room filled with some of the most recognisable faces in film, and for the millions watching at home, the moment landed with shock and discomfort. For the two black actors on stage, for the audience in the auditorium, for viewers who didn't know the context, Davidson has since issued an apology saying he's deeply mortified that anyone who heard the slur may have considered the tick to have been intentional. But the moment and the BBC's decision not to edit the broadcast to exclude the slur from the televised version has sparked heated debate. How do we make spaces genuinely accessible and inclusive for everyone? And do we actually understand the nuances of a condition like Tourette's? Well, here to help me make sense of it today is Tourette's Syndrome Association of Australia President Mandy Macy and Tourette's Ambassador Seamus Evans. Seamus, I might start with you. Looking at this play out, what's going through your mind?
I actually think it's a really perfect depiction of Tourette's and how it actually plays out and the reality of it. So we've got, I mean, this is not a new situation. I know many people with that same tick. And the truth is they can't go out in public in some instances. Sometimes they have to close the shops down so they can go out and buy themselves some underwear, for goodness sake. So I think it's a really accurate depiction of the truth of Tourette's. And I personally don't think there should have been any editing. They should have just let them all out and then shown, hey, this is actually how it is. We've just made a movie about it, and this is the reality.
Why not edit it when a word, whether it's intentional or not, still carries the ability to harm?
Well, if this individual, they've made a movie about his life and the movie is okay to win an award, but his tick and his condition isn't acceptable to be broadcast live, I think that's pretty double. I think that's, it's not good enough, you know. They're okay to make a movie about it and win an award, but they're not okay to have him in the actual audience and ticking live. Oh no, don't let everybody hear that. But they just made a movie about it.
Interesting. Well, sorry, I'm interested to kind of unpack this a bit. In the room, disclosures were given. Watching at home, we didn't have that context. What kind of communication might have helped people understand it better?
I do think it's really important. Communication is always the key here. I know many people with Tourette's, with coprolalia, which is the swearing profanity tick, where, you know, they're arrested, they're beaten up. There have been many times with my tics, I don't have coprolalia, but I've got a head nodding backwards as if I'm saying g'day to someone. Mm. I've done that many times in public, and people try and start fights with me because they're like, oi, what are you looking at? You want to talk to me, mate? You know? So I think it then ensues a conversation after the fact. Oh, no, mate, I've got Tourette's. Now, if we are predicting, hey, this person we've just made a movie about and they're up for a BAFTA is going to be in the audience and they have coprolalia, yeah, there probably should have been a bit of a disclaimer. Just like before any movie, if there's any sort of violent themes, any adult themes, they say a disclaimer at the beginning. So I think, yeah, I think they should have done a disclaimer and then let all ticks go to air.
So, Mandy, you're the president of the Tourette Syndrome Association of Australia. You've got three children with it. What's going through your mind when you're watching this clip and the subsequent debate?
It's difficult because having been in that situation, a quiet auditorium where people are up on stage and my kids are hurling abuse at the people on stage and everybody in the audience is having a bit of a moment. And pretty much anywhere and everywhere you go, you will find that there are people that, you know, well, their tics are happening and people are judging. You get a bit of a thick skin. So words for us as a family, I know, don't have as much a power, I guess, as for a lot of other people. So, I mean, when my oldest has turned around to me in the past and looked me dead in the eye and said, I hope you die, you bee, you know, get cancer and, you know, you're a loser. Yeah, and it hurts. But I also know that he didn't mean it because it's his tics. I have the privilege of knowing the difference, I guess, between what's a tic and what's not a tic. And I know not to take it personally, but... you know, when you live with Tourette's, you get, you know, as a parent of somebody with Tourette's, you get punched in the face, you get bitten, you get slapped, you get kicked, and they're all tics. It's not deliberate. And yes, it hurts, but they can't help it, and it hurts them immensely. And when we look at the statistics for people with Tourette syndrome, and I'm going to touch on a sensitive subject here, but 4 out of 5 people with Tourette's attempt suicide because of the pressure of the social isolation and just the pressure of living with the condition. So I think we should not detract from that. But having said that, it is a terrible word. It's a horrible word. Makes my mouth feel awful just the thought of saying the word that was said to Michael and Delroy. So every person of colour in that room must have felt horrific. But they were all warned beforehand. I think if we're going to lay the blame in anybody's feet, the BBC and BAFTA should have done something about it. They should not have placed a microphone right next to where John was sat. And they should have checked up on how everybody was after the event. And I don't think that was what happened from what I understand. But it's not the only slur that he said during the evening. He said lots of slurs. That's just the one that happened to be picked up. That's the one that happened to be left in when others were actually muted.
Can we talk about tics? Lisa on the text line, if you want to send me a text, my number is 0418-226-576. Lisa's asking, can you ask your guest if the involuntary words are in the person's head, but unlike those of us without the condition, don't have the ability to filter out the unacceptable words? Seamus, I know you said you don't have coprolalia, this explicit version of Tourette's, but can you speak to ticking? What's going on?
Yeah, so the way everybody's brain works is everyone's brain self-regulates just to stay alive, and your brain will just fire off random unwanted signals, and everybody has a gate to stop those unwanted signals, but people with Tourette's just have a weak gate. So it's like, imagine having a gate without a lock. It just kind of flies open and shut every now and then, right? So those messages that are unwanted that everybody's brain does, they fire through. Some get through and some don't. So my ability, I have been able to redirect because I've been able to identify that message, catch the message mid path, so to speak, and try and redirect it. But it definitely is like an itch on your arm, you know. Unconsciously, if you're itchy, you're going to scratch without thinking. You won't even notice you're doing it. And that's not to say I redirect every single one of them. Many of them get through, and many people say, oh, you're ticking, and I won't even realize. They just happen.
What makes that gate weaker or stronger? Does the environment play a role for you or your mental state?
Definitely anxiety, being tired, stress and things like that will increase your tics and make you tick more. The other thing as well is seeing people tick, thinking about tics, thinking people are looking at you.
Yeah.
So I definitely feel there's a huge mental game at play when it comes to my redirecting. There has to be a psychological element of winning your brain first. But at the end of the day, you tick. They fire through, and sometimes you catch them, sometimes you can't.
Mandy, how have you managed that as a parent, helping your kids develop strategies that can help them with this?
It's really difficult. We as a family have always been very, very aware that we are in a unique position to advocate for Tourette syndrome. So we try to live loud and proud, if that makes any sense. I have always said, and there's been a lot of controversy actually with John's apology when he said, "I'm sorry if what I said offended you." And people said that wasn't him taking responsibility. But when you tick, you have no control over it. You can apologise for hurting someone's feelings. You can apologise for physically hurting someone. But you shouldn't actually have to apologise for ticking. People don't apologise for being in a wheelchair. People don't apologise for being blind. So ticks are very much disabling in the same way. But they shouldn't have to apologise. So I've always tried to make the distinction that apologise for the hurt, but do not apologise for ticking because you can't help it. You grow a thick skin because people are always pointing, staring, or asking you, why is your kid doing that? My youngest was, they developed coprolalia when they were in grade 2 at school. And the words out of their mouth are not words that you don't want to hear any kid in grade 2 saying. But the school handled it beautifully. But it's a constant advocating, constant arguments, constant meetings with the school to try and smooth things over, and just that never-ending need to educate.
You are listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor, chatting with Mandy Macy, who's the president of the Tourette Syndrome Association of Australia, and Seamus Evans, who's a public speaker and advocate with the Tourette Syndrome of Australia, talking about what happened at the BAFTAs, where a man with Tourette syndrome who was there because they'd made a movie about his life that was celebrating has sort of been overshadowed by a tic that was caught on a microphone, which was a racial slur that happened while two black actors were up on the stage. And just balancing this inclusion space for people with a condition like Tourette's and also the harm that that word can cause and has caused to people. And on the text line, you're telling me your thoughts about it. Melissa says, "I don't think the Tourette person's well-being trumps the black actor's well-being." We heard Seamus's take on this before, Mandy. What do you say to that?
Look, I am not a person of colour. I cannot speak for people of colour. I do understand that the word is an incredibly painful word. I'm not trying to detract from the upset and pain that was caused to everybody, every person of colour that heard that. But it is about intent. And two things can exist in the same space. We do have to be aware that hurt was caused. But in the same vein, we also have to accept the fact that the person ticking, John, did not mean it. It was not intentional. Everybody in that room on the evening had watched the film because they were all voting members. So everybody had seen the film. Everybody was well aware of what John was capable of. The BBC and BAFTA have worked with John in the the BBC has worked with John in the past. BAFTA were well aware that he has copro. I think there's an awful lot of things that could have been done to protect everybody concerned.
I think it's probably worth calling out the fact that none of the three of us are African American.
Absolutely.
White people talking about something that we don't have lived experience of, and someone's called this out on the text line, I think it'd be great for this segment on Tourette's to have an African-American in the discussion to hear the other side of the argument. I will say there have been some creators who've spoken out about this. I do want to play a clip from a black woman living with Tourette's who posted on social media. Her name's Shayla Amamiya. This is what some of what she had to say.
Coprolalia causes involuntary swearing and inappropriate tics. This can include the N-word, slurs, etc. I am a black person and even I have the N-word tic and slurs as tics. This is something I don't see many talk about because of situations like this. Is it a disappointing thing, shut up, that it happened in public in front of that entire crowd? Michael B. Jordan and the other presenter have the right to be upset, especially if they were not aware. However, we need to understand and educate ourselves. It is okay to be offended, shut up. But what it is not okay to do is be ableist and try to make it seem like people with Tourette's, specifically those with coprolalia, say their tics on purpose.
So that is Shayla Amamiya, a black woman living with Tourette's, talking about it on social media. I actually really recommend you check out her channel if you want some more insight. She's really thoughtful on this. Another text coming through. I'd like to ask if people with Tourette's are able to select their words. I understand they produce involuntary sounds and movement, but can they filter? Seamus, you talked a bit about your experience before. Mandy, do you want to speak to that from what your kids deal with?
Yeah, absolutely. And also, as part of the education process that we do with the Tourette Syndrome Association, we talk about this a lot when we're trying to educate in schools. So the coprolalia especially is based very much, taboo words are based more in relation to emotion rather than vocabulary in our brains. That's where they're stored. And one of the things that we have with Tourette syndrome is there are an awful lot of intrusive thoughts. And as Seamus was saying earlier on, the gate doesn't hold the thoughts. We have an excess of neurotransmitters that flood the gate and the gate can't cope. The intrusive thoughts are, what's the worst thing I could say at this point? Oh, my God, wouldn't it be awful if I said? And John says it in his book, you know, he called the Queen some awful things, but he was thinking on the way there, you know, what happens if I say that to her? What happens if I say this to her? And it would have been exactly the same for him the night of the BAFTAs. But the thing with coprolalia is that... you're reaching in, the brain is reaching, sorry, let me start again. Because it's a taboo word and it's based in emotion, there is a bigger dopamine hit. And one of the things that people with Tourette syndrome have is a very, very low, we burn through dopamine really, really quickly. And because that dopamine is burnt through, there's that never-ending chase for more dopamine because you're stressed, because you're upset, because you're overexcited. The dopamine is burnt up. So you need something that's going to hit the dopamine. So the obsessive thoughts come in and they say, wouldn't it be awful if we said that? And the gate stops the neurotransmitters from, doesn't stop them. And the words that create the most dopamine are the ones that are linked to your emotions. Therefore, it's the taboo words that are going to come out because that's going to create the dopamine, which is going to regulate the nervous system, which is going to make the person with Tourette's a little bit more comfortable. Now, all of that goes on in the brain without the person with Tourette's actually being in control of it. So you can't control it. A lot of tics will be situational, hence the N-word. And if it was an incredibly overweight person, then there would have been something related to weight on in the tic. If there was somebody with burns up on the stage, there would have been something related to the, disfigurement or scars. If somebody's in a wheelchair, it'll be something about not being able to walk. That's just the very nature of the brain saying, don't say it, don't say it, don't say it, don't say it. And that's how it works.
Seamus, for better or worse, this episode has brought Tourette's into the spotlight. What do you hope people take away and understand about it?
I think it's really important that everybody gets a better understanding of human beings and what humans go through. Earlier there was a text message says about the someone's offence doesn't someone's feeling doesn't trump someone else's feelings. I don't think you can compare suffering. And I think this goes across the board with all human beings. We're all going through our own little journey and we're all going through our own human being experience. And I think it's really important to be kind to one another. And I think more than anything, that's, I mean, I know it sounds silly to say that, but I think less judgment, more kindness.
Thank you so much, both of you, for joining me today. Mandy Maisie is the president of the Tourette Syndrome Association of Australia. Seamus Evans, public speaker and advocate with the association. And we heard Mandy talk about the mental health toll that this syndrome can take on people. If this story has brought up stuff for you, reach out for help. Tourette's Syndrome Association Australia has lots of resources online. You can search them. You can also always call Lifeline 13 11 14 or Beyond Blue 1300 22 4636. And coming up next here on Life Matters on ABC Radio National, if I told you that in 10 years' time, kids would be going to daycare at their local public school, would you be on board?
Smarten up your afternoons on ABC Radio National each weekday at 1:30.
On Mondays, it's The Science Show.
Every Tuesday, I ask, what the duck?
Science fiction on Wednesdays.
All in the Mind on Thursdays.
Then on Fridays, What's That Rash?
And Lab Notes.
You bring the lunch.
We bring the science.
We'll bring the science.
1:30 weekdays right here on ABC Radio National.
Australia is having a reckoning moment for the 1.5 million children enrolled in childcare. You've heard the horrific stories, a system dominated by profit, infiltrated by predators, chronic staff shortages, ultimately our kids being left behind. Over the last week, there's been hearings at a Senate inquiry into the quality and safety of Australia's early childhood system, and the report is due at the end of next month. Some groups want more flexible choice for subsidised care outside the existing daycare system. Others want to reimagine it entirely. One of the options put forward is universal childcare. So what does that mean? Is it achievable? And what would it look like? Georgie Dent is with me. She's the CEO of The Parenthood, a childcare and parenting advocacy organisation. It's behind the push for a universal childcare system. Georgie, first things first, can you remember your own phone number?
Good morning. And yes, on most days I can. But I feel you because I have been in that position before where I couldn't.
Let's talk about childcare. Universal childcare, does that mean it's free?
So I think when we talk about a universal system, it's useful to think about some of the existing universal systems that we have. And so, for example, with schools or hospitals. And so most people are familiar with the schooling system. So if we look at that for a minute, wherever you live, if you've got a child that is at school age, there is a position available for them at the local school and enrolling them is simple. And at most of the public primary schools around Australia, there is some fee that parents pay, but it's nominal. It's not, we're not asking parents to fund the full operating of schools. And so it's far more affordable. When we think about what a universal early education and care system could look like, we think about a couple of key principles. It has to be safe, it has to be simple, it has to be affordable, and it has to be available. And they're the sort of principles that we think must underpin a universal early education and care system.
Those four words you just said feel like they should be the bare minimum. But if anything, from the last year, the reporting, the Senate inquiry has shown us that's not the case in a lot of instances.
Yes, absolutely. And the case is that far too few families in Australia have got genuine choice when it comes to the early education and care that their children have access to. So we've got families who live in areas where there are just no services available. We've got families who live in areas where the services that are available turn their children away because their needs are deemed too high for that particular service. We've got other families who are in the system, but the cost is so prohibitive that they're barely keeping their heads above water. So when we think about those principles, where we are right now, we are not in a position where families do have access in every instance to safe, affordable, accessible, simple early education and care. And we have to move to that place. And I think it's relevant to sort of consider why we're having this conversation about universal early education and care. And the truth is that back in October 2020, when the now Prime Minister was the opposition leader, he stood in Parliament and said that if he was to become the Prime Minister, the ultimate legacy he would like to leave is universal early childhood education and care. Now, for the Parenthood, we're an advocacy organisation. We represent 80,000 parents and carers around the country. We started in 2013 and we have been campaigning for that vision since then. So for us to have that commitment made and for then the opposition leader to become the Prime Minister and in government, we are on a path towards building a universal early education and care system. It is very clear that we are not near that yet. And there is significant amounts of work that need to be done to build that system. But it's really important to recognise why we need that system. And the reason we need that system is because it's twofold. Children benefit when they have the opportunity to participate in high quality early education and care. But secondly, for parents, particularly in the current economic climate where it is a very privileged position where a parent doesn't have to be engaged in the paid workforce for an extended period of time. Most families require parents to be working. And what that means is for parents of small children, if they don't have family nearby who can step in and fill that gap, they need to rely on some form of early education and care. So it is really essential infrastructure. I often describe it as sort of like the roads and the bridges that parents need in order to move between their caring responsibilities in the home and the paid work they need to participate in to provide for their family.
How does this differ from some of the other options that are on the table? Because it's not the only revised model that's under consideration.
So I think that there's been a huge amount of conversation and focus really in the last 12 months, which we think is absolutely welcome because, as I said, early education and care is critical infrastructure. It's not a niche luxury. You know, we know that the vast majority of households require some form of early education and care. And at the moment, centre-based care is the primary service that is used. So we know there's 1.4 million children who currently participate in that system. When we talk about what are the choices for families, choice is predicated on there being options available. And as I've said, at the moment, a lot of families don't have options available. When we talk about building a universal early education and care system, it's not saying that it's compulsory and it's certainly not saying that it's one size fits all. The ACCC in its inquiry in 2024 was really clear on this, that in a country as diverse as Australia, universal will never be able to translate to uniform because we have got communities that are going to need different options. And we believe that building a universal platform where there is a safe, simple, affordable, quality option for every family and child who needs it, without that foundation, then choice becomes something that is only exercised by those who can afford it. And that's not to say that we don't need alternatives in the system. At the Parenthood, we have been advocating really fiercely, particularly over the last 5 years, for families who live in regional, rural and remote communities. And we know that those families need high quality, well-regulated, suitable options for care. And we know that far too many of those communities don't have that right now. But if we don't have the sort of a universal platform that is available for families who need it, then choice is theoretical.
You're listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor, chatting with Georgie Dent, who's the CEO of the Parenthood, an advocacy group representing parents and carers, talking about the Senate inquiry into the quality and safety of Australia's early childhood system. Its report is due at the end of next month. It comes on the back of a lot of reporting, a lot of it from the ABC last year, uncovering some real chasms in quality when it comes to early childhood education and care in Australia. I'm asking you this morning what your roadmap would look like if you were charged with redesigning our early childcare system. Yes, simply put it into a single text to me. We'll fix it together. And Georgie, I'm really seeing a theme with some of the texts that I'm getting. Rhonda says, why do so-called solutions to childcare never include supporting a parent to look after their own children and receive the subsidy that would otherwise be paid to a childcare centre? The hidden agenda, of course, Rhonda says, is to get the parent back into the workforce as soon as possible. Kelly in New South Wales says, I think consideration should be given to financial support for parents to look after their own young children. I have two twice exceptional kids who went to preschool and mainstream school, but prior to that, I resigned to look after them at home. Some extra money would have helped. Georgie, where would that fit into the system you're proposing?
So at The Parenthood, we have been really explicit that we don't think we can have a sensible conversation about a universal early education and care system if we're not talking about expanding paid parental leave to 12 months. We know that it is critically important to give parents and babies the opportunity to be at home in that first year. We know that right now, a lot of parents are forced back to work before they are genuinely ready because they simply do not have the option of staying at home. And we believe that it is absolutely time for Australia to expand our paid parental leave so that we are in line with the average length of paid parental leave that's available in OECD countries. And at the moment, the average length of paid parental leave that families in OECD countries have is over 53 weeks. So in Australia, we have welcomed the expansion of paid parental leave from 18 weeks to 26 weeks. We have welcomed the inclusion of superannuation on that. But it is absolutely critical that we expand paid parental leave to 12 months to give families the breathing space that they need. And I think we need to recognise that there has been a fundamental structural shift in our economy and our family units. As I have referenced, it is just not financially viable for very many families to have a parent staying at home for a long period of time. We believe that having adequate paid parental leave, at least 12 months, is one part of the picture that families need in those early years. And then we believe that it is critically important that families have the opportunity, if they need it, if they choose it, to have their child participate in a high-quality early education and care setting so that if they need to participate in the paid workforce, they can do so while having the trust and confidence that their children are being well supported. One of the problems that we have is the childcare subsidy, which is the current funding mechanism for early childhood education and care, has led us to the place that we're in and has led us to the absolutely devastating revelations about the extent to which children and families have been failed in early learning centres around Australia. So the childcare subsidy has underpinned an exponential growth in for-profit provision of childcare. And the childcare subsidy has not driven supply in areas of need. It has Providers are incentivized to open services in areas where they can make a bigger profit, and that is largely dependent on the out-of-pocket fees parents are able to pay. So that's why we have a situation where, you know, a quarter of Australian families live in what's described as a childcare desert, where there are no services available, or there are three children for every one position that's available. That's because the childcare subsidy has simply incentivized providers to set up in areas where they can make a profit. The childcare subsidy has not driven the requisite improvements that we need in quality and safety. It has made the out-of-pocket cost exorbitant for so many households. So we believe there's a really strong case for looking at the funding model and saying, how can we fund early childhood education and care in a way that means we are giving children high quality early learning experiences? And fundamentally, that comes down to the workforce. How well qualified, how well supported, how well paid are the early childhood educators and teachers? And unfortunately, the childcare subsidy has been incredibly inefficient at driving the right sort of outcomes for children, parents, and educators. and instead has created a market. And it is very clear that the market has not delivered on the needs of Australian families and communities.
But Georgie,
and so,
sorry, you're talking about a year of paid parental leave, more access in all parts of Australia, you know, universal childcare, the ability for any kid in Australia to sort of find a place in the right spot for them. Don't get me wrong, I love it, but it sounds really expensive. Have you done costing on this?
We have looked at the costing, and there's no doubt that it is expensive, but we are currently, the latest Productivity Commission report that was released a couple of weeks ago showed that we are spending $20 billion on the childcare subsidy. Parents are spending a serious chunk in addition to that on the out-of-pocket cost. So we are spending at the moment an exorbitant amount of money on a childcare system that is not available to a quarter of the population, that has driven growth in the sort of for-profit part of the market, when we know that the evidence is really clear that not-for-profit and community-controlled, community-run organisations that are not-for-profit deliver a much more consistent standard of quality. And so while we recognise that the moving to a different funding model is going to reallocate some of that cost, but we think it will take out, we believe we need to take out some of the opaque ability for providers to be making a profit, because at the moment we don't have a clear eye on what early childhood education and care should actually cost us. I also think it's worth pointing out that when we think about schools, and I know I've referenced this a lot, but if you think about how our school system works, parents aren't expected to cover the full cost of running a school. But we recognise that children having the ability to participate in education is critically important. It's essential infrastructure. The evidence around the early years is very compelling that we can actually change the trajectory of a child's life if we give them the opportunity to participate in high-quality early education. And so while there is definitely a cost, the Commonwealth Government is currently running a project with Deloitte looking at what is the true cost of delivering quality early education and care. And that piece of work, we understand, will inform decisions about how we do fund early education and care in the future. But we think that it is really worthwhile considering the extent to which the childcare subsidy has failed children, families and educators, and how that has led us to where we are now.
Georgie, thank you so much for articulating this today. Really appreciate you making the time. Georgie Dent is the CEO of The Parenthood, a childcare and parenting advocacy organisation behind the push for a universal childcare system. And as I said before, the results of that Senate inquiry will be published the end of next month, so watch this space. And thank you for your texts as well. Carl says, to assist with childcare issues, the start is to have solid parental leave available for men/fathers. I understand this does not help same-sex families, but is an essential part. Lisa says, we have been talking about universal childcare for over 40 years of my life. It's shameful we don't have it in place still. There's nothing fairer than spending our tax dollars on childcare. After all, every one of us starts as a child. We would all benefit from money spent on policies for childhood well-being. Well, coming up soon here on Life Matters, I am asking the very serious question as to whether if you transplanted your head onto another body, would it still be you? But first, I want to know what strange enterprises you've pursued for money. My next guest on My Two Cents, his musical talents have taken him to weddings, partings, anything to make a quid, really. That's next here on ABC Radio National.
It's the night to come as you are, to be celebrated and united in pride. A night of fearless self-expression, spectacular floats, unforgettable costumes, and pure joy.
We are back!
The excitement, it's exploding.
The Sydney Gay and Lesbian Mardi Gras Parade.
It's like my favourite event of the year.
Live Saturday, February 28 from 7:30 p.m. on ABC TV and ABC iView.
In our regular segment, My Two Cents, I ask the questions that you would rather not answer about money. You've heard how comedians, adventurers, and musicians manage their money so far. a theme is emerging among the musicians. Their money management is always a little chaotic, but somehow they manage to land on their feet. And it is definitely true of veteran rock and roller Mick Thomas of Weddings, Parties, Anything and Mick Thomas's Roving Commission. He got approved for a loan to buy a house over a handshake on the side of the road. And if you see Mick in the street, don't ask where he got his boots from.
I'm Mick Thomas, and I earn a living by playing gigs and selling records. My last three purchases were I bought a new amplifier, thinking that it was going to, you know, change my life and change everything, and I took it to the gig and no one even noticed, so there was that. I bought a Melways roadmap. It's just nice to flick through and just get an idea of where you are, which you just don't get from Google Maps that I find. And the third thing I bought was on Marketplace, I saw advertised a guy had some new boots, and they were new ones, and I went to buy them, and he had a whole lot there. He was just working out of a flat, and I don't know how he came to have all those boots, but I said, geez, I'll take two pairs. I was struck with the realisation that, you know, boots tend to last me about 10 years, and that at 65, having bought two pairs, they're probably going to see me out. So that was a kind of a realisation that I had on the way home from that purchase. Look, when I was growing up, money was something that we didn't discuss much in our family. My parents had lived through the Great Depression, and they'd gone through a fair bit of stuff, and they weren't penny pinchers by any means, but it was just something we didn't talk about very much. So money was always a bit of a mystical thing for us. I do own my own home, and it is kind of interesting because sort of at the height of the weddings, unbeknownst to most people, we were in dreadful debt. Like, we just kept touring and getting further and further behind, and that was for a lot of bad decisions at management level. And anyway, we had this bank manager in Collingwood. He was a sort of funny guy, and I just remember I was walking past a cafe called Melissa's, and I just heard, "Mick." And I looked around, and it was this bank manager, and he's sitting there, and he said, "Right," he goes, "I've never seen a worse manager of money than your manager." He said, "He is a financial delinquent." And I went, "Okay." And he said, "Right, here's the deal." He said, "All your publishing money is wound up tying up the band's overdraft." And I said, "Yeah, that's right." He said, "Well, you haven't taken any money for about 3 years." I said, "Nah." He said, "I'll lend you the money that's securing the overdraft." So he said, "I'll do that if you buy a house." And I was living above the Punters Club at the time and just sort of enjoying life, really. And I went, "Oh, okay." He said, "So go and buy a house." I said, "All right." So I sort of went and looked, and I found one, and he gave me that money, and he said, "But you got to promise me you're going to pay it back." And I said, "Yeah, I guess so." You know, the wedding split up not that long after that, and that was probably the most financially lucrative period of my life, really, because I was just doing a little job, sort of did a job. I just knocked a bit of this weird kind of overdraft situation, just sort of knocked it down, and you know, probably within a couple of years, had it down to zero and could just sit about paying the rest of the house off. So that's how that happened. But it was very unintentional on my part. I guess I'm less than decisive with money. So, you know, I know that a couple of managers, when they've come on board, have been at great pains to sort of do budgets for tours and, you know, do spreadsheets and all that sort of thing. And they go, "Well, where's the spreadsheet from the last tour that you did?" And I go, "Oh, I haven't got one, you know, just, you know, it's just cross the fingers." And it'd be $25,000 before I step onto a stage. Whether that all comes back is kind of almost a moot point. As long as I can get to that first gig, or I call it the little boat of profit, which, you know, gets sort of sails away from you, you know, and then when you first, you know, sell a record or do a gig, the boat's turned around and starts heading back towards you, you know, and hopefully, you know, at some stage it docks at your pier and goes back the other way into the ocean of profit. When I think about debt, it's something on a more personal level, aside from the business side of things, that I've been lucky enough to sort of keep clear of and get the house paid off. I don't like it. I've got very little in the way of superannuation or anything like that, but I keep talking to my accountant and she just says, look, as long as you stay debt-free and you own, you know, quite a decent house outright, that's kind of your superannuation. So I hope she's right. My financial goals are just to stay debt-free and just get through the last part of my life with my wife and my young child, and so that, you know, whatever happens later on, there's not a debt to service, and that's simple as it can be to me. So I never sort of take it for granted, the fact that people will still want to come to shows or buy a record. I'm Mick Thomas, and that's my 2 cents worth.
Thank you so much, Mick Thomas, for sharing your money stories. Here are my 2 cents. May the little boat of profit be forever sailing in your direction. Mick has actually just dropped a new single and film clip ahead of a national tour. He'll be touring April through June around Australia. You are with Life Matters on ABC Radio National. It sounds like something straight out of a sci-fi film or the fantasies of the super rich trying to play God and live forever. I am talking about head transplants. It's been about 70 years since the first successful organ transplant. It was a kidney. And ever since, science has been testing the limits of what's possible. And attaching a living human head to a donor body feels like the ultimate frontier. And as detailed in a write-up in Popular Science this month, there are scientists who are working towards this goal. But whether it's Frankenstein or other thought experiments, writers and philosophers have long been captivated by the idea of mind swaps, literal and metaphorical. If your head is on a new body, are you still you? Where does our consciousness actually reside? And even if such a transplant were possible, should we do it? What ethical dilemmas would it unleash? Given that this is such a serious topic, I'm asking you a serious question today. If you could put your head on anybody, what body would you choose? With me is Patrick Stokes, Associate Professor of Philosophy at Deakin University. He joins me fortnightly for our segment, Ask Aristotle. Patrick, are you with me, soul, mind, and body this morning?
Yeah, to the extent that I ever am.
Have you ever thought about chucking your head on a new body or your body under a new head?
Yeah, all the time. Doing laps last night at the pool going, oh God, I wish I had somebody else's body and not
swap
this
Ian
one.
Thorpe's body in here.
But I mean, look, yes, everyone to some extent has at some point that fantasy of it would be interesting to be this other person or you look at some extremely fit person or extremely agile person or somebody's gifted with, say, considerably more rhythm and grace than me, for instance, and you think, God, it would be nice to have that bodily experience, to have that experience of being in a body that's tuned to the world differently. But there's interesting questions around whether we can even really imagine what it would be like to be in a different body, because in fact our embodiment is so central to what we take experience to be in the first place.
When I was reading this story in Popular Science about head transplants, it actually is something that scientists are working towards. And I think I was just sort of like, well, yeah, if you could do it, your brain's in your head, you put it on another body, kind of it doesn't really matter. But philosophy isn't as cut and dried about where we actually sit in our bodies.
Well, there's a lot of move away from this idea that we are somewhere in our skulls, right? The idea that who you essentially are is in your brain's doing all the thinking, so that's who you are, and that, you know, your selfhood is therefore in that brain, and you could pair your body back to the brain and it would still be you if you could keep the brain alive and thinking. The sort of what's sometimes called the brain in a vat scenario. A lot of philosophy is starting to push back on that. A lot of the moves in philosophy of mind have been towards a thing called inactivism and other areas where they're sort of saying, no, we need to think of thinking as something that a whole organism does. You're thinking with your whole body, with all the sensory data that's coming in, and you're also thinking in conjunction with your environment. We need to think of thinking on some of these newer models as something that the organism does in concert with the world around it and in concert with other organisms as well. So in a way, if you're on your mobile phone, your phone is an extension of your mind. If you're writing things down in a notebook, your notebook is an extension of your mind. And you're actually offloading some of your cognitive work into the environment and vice versa. So the idea that we're just here in our skulls is that at the very least it's getting a lot of pushback, but it's still a really powerful way of thinking about selfhood that I think is very deeply ingrained in us and quite hard to shake off.
Is that not unscientific though? Like your brain is in your skull.
Your brain's in your skull, but your whole central nervous system isn't in your skull, right? It's spread throughout your whole body, and that's where you're doing a lot of your thinking. A lot of the stuff that your brain is doing too is stuff you're not aware of as well, which involves other organs in your body, right? So your brain is constantly, for instance, getting feedback about what your hormones are doing throughout your body, and it's regulating those. It's getting information about what your heartbeat and your blood pressure and so on are doing, and it's doing things to regulate those. But you're not aware of any of that. So the stuff that we call consciousness is really only on the very top level of awareness, the stuff that we're kind of where the system has become aware of its own monitoring of itself in a way is where consciousness is said to happen in sort of physical terms. But yeah, I mean, it is true that we still think of ourselves as being inside our heads, partly because that's where our brain is, but also because that's where we see the world from, right? That's where our perspective is organized. It's organized around our eyes and our ears. And so we tend to think of ourselves as being at the center of that perspective, but it's not clear that that's the best way to think about selfhood.
This is something that philosophers have been thinking about for like literally hundreds of years, well before there was any sense that this could ever be scientifically possible. And I should say the science of it is still a pretty long way off. Tell me about how John Locke conceived of this idea.
Ah, Johnny Locke, J-Loke, the
J-Star. J-Loke, the original J-Loke.
Yeah, he basically has this chapter in his book from the 1690s, which he couldn't publish during his lifetime because it would get him in too much trouble. But in this particular chapter, he sort of talks about the idea of selfhood as extension of consciousness. And he's really dealing with the idea that people thought that selfhood was about your soul and that you went wherever your soul went. But he said it's really more to do with consciousness. And one of the examples he gave of that, he says, was imagine that a prince and a cobbler swapped souls in the middle of the night. Now, if they were to do that, we wouldn't say, oh no, the cobbler has woken up with the mind of a prince. We would say, oh, the prince has woken up in the body of a cobbler, right? And that priority suggests that we think of identity as linked to mind and linked to experience. And so basically your identity goes where your mind goes. It doesn't stay with your body.
It's literally the plot to Freaky Friday and a thousand other movies I can think of, including
every second movie in the 80s depends on this. Eric Olson, who's a British philosopher, called it the transplant intuition, right? He says, we have this idea that your identity travels with your mind. And if we didn't have that transplant intuition, none of those movies would make any sense. Right? We wouldn't be able to follow the plot of Freaky Friday or anything like that. The whole thing is driven by this intuition that we go with our minds.
Underrated Aussie movie, Dating the Enemy, also similar plot. I have been asking you this morning who you would swap bodies with. One person says Nelson Mandela and then texts back saying, no, Grace Jones, final choice. Stocky says, I would put my head on my dog Obi's body and chase stuff all day. He looks so happy chasing and retrieving. What are the ethics of a head transplant? And I must preface this by saying you've got about a minute to explain it, Pat.
Well, there's the questions around identity, where that goes. The other thing with head transplants and also face transplants, which are a real thing, is not only could they be identity compromising, but you'd also have to be on so many immunosuppressants that there would just be huge medical ethical questions around it, because that's really dangerous to do unless you absolutely have to do it.
Well, Pat, thank you as always for joining me. It's always such a delight, especially talking about such real and serious things as we are talking about today.
Thanks, Tegan.
Patrick Stokes is an Associate Professor of Philosophy at Deakin University. He joins me fortnightly for our segment, Ask Aristotle. I do wonder what Aristotle would have to say about today's discussion. On the text line, the other Malcolm says, C.S. Lewis wrote about head transplants in the 1940s. Check out That Hideous Strength. Didn't realise there were C.S. Lewis stories I'd never heard of before. Well, that is just about it for Life Matters, coming to you today from Jagera and Turrbal Land. Earlier in the show, we were talking about Australia's childcare system, what reimagining it could look like, what a universal childcare system could look like. And lots of you have had opinions on how we can fix that. One person says, what could be more important than giving children the best start in life? That and the environment are worth any amount of money spent on them intelligently. Katrina says in France, children start their education at age 3, which is part of the public education system. I think having a similar public system for every child in Australia would be a game changer for providing equity in access to education. Well, tomorrow here on ABC Radio National's Life Matters, Beverly Wang will be with you again. She's going to be talking about your relationship with debt. More than ever, Australians are carrying personal debt, so maybe that's something you're fine with, or maybe it's something that you feel a sense of shame about. Either way, Beverly will be taking your calls tomorrow. You can give her a call after 9 a.m. then, and you can get in touch with me and the Life Matters team anytime. lifematters@abc.net.au is the email address. Catch you next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.